Hey, it's Francis Lamb, and thanks for downloading this Splendid Table podcast. We hope you count on us for cooking, culture, and conversation all year round. And we count on support from listeners like you. So please, help chip in to help us make the show you'll love. Give today at splendidtable.org/donate.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. In the Rome of the Caesars, you could have had yards of Chinese silk cut out for an outfit. And at about the same time in China, a princess was buried with what was described as a pasta maker from the West, along with detailed notes on pasta dishes. The Great Silk Road had begun, and it would, and this is no exaggeration, change the world. The trade route began in China, climbed into treacherous mountain ranges, and down into lands with names like Desert of Death. Well, an insane route? Maybe. But the payoffs could be astronomical. At the Silk Road's hub was a mythical-sounding city, Samarkand. The proverbial crossroads of foods, peoples, cultures, and goods that we can only imagine. So, is anything left today? British travel writer Caroline Eden had to know, as did her colleague, food writer Eleanor Ford. Their discoveries are in the book Samarkand, Recipes and Stories from Central Asia and the Caucasus. Caroline, Eleanor, good to have you with us.
Hello.
Thank you for
having us.
Lovely
to be with you.
Caroline, where is Samarkand? Because this is a part of the world we're not familiar with.
Okay, so Samarkand is a city in Uzbekistan. It's not the capital city. The capital city is Tashkent. And it sits between Iran and China. It is north of Afghanistan. And it is south of Kazakhstan.
Okay, so we're talking mountains and desert, right?
And that's right.
And this was the crossroad of the Silk Roads. So what took you there?
I first went to Samarkand in 2009, really inspired by the Mughal architecture of northern India. So the founder of the Mughal Empire was Babur, and Babur was born in modern-day Uzbekistan. So having fallen in love with this fantastic Mughal architecture, I thought I have to go to Uzbekistan and go back to the roots. Mm-hmm. And that was really what took me there.
So what were your first impressions?
My first impressions were just wow. I had been traveling in Tajikistan in quite rough mountain territory for a few weeks. And I crossed the border and drove into Samarkand. And all of a sudden I was surrounded by shining turquoise tiles, sweeping high minarets and beautiful sandstone, and it was everything I'd hoped for and more. It was just like being transported back to the 14th century. It was sort of Arabian Nights come true.
Oh my. You actually wrote that it shook you.
It really did. You know when there's somewhere that you really want to go to and then you finally arrive there and you think, I really hope this doesn't disappoint me. It was everything that I'd hoped it would be. It wasn't very touristy, so I kind of had the place to myself, which was very special and obviously quite hard to find in the world. It was just very otherworldly. I had a particularly stirring experience at the Shah Azinda, which is an acropolis, and I arrived there very early one morning, and I was the only one there, and I could hear the imams chanting, and I just sat and listened, and I just thought, this place is incredible. Why don't more people come here?
Eleanor, your first impressions?
Well, for me, it's always food that draws me on my travels and that excites me the most. And I think, for me, Samarkand is so incredible because it's historically and still today such a cultural crossroads. And that means that the melting pot of people and cultures have each brought their own influence to the food there. Which made it so fascinating to me as a food writer, looking at the different dishes and unpicking the history and the influences behind them.
What kinds of dishes are we talking about? What is the food like?
Well, I think returning to the map of the regions perhaps helpful in this, because, you know, to the east there's China, and so therefore you've got the flavours coming over like ginger and soy sauce, vinegar, You have manti, little steamed dumplings, rather like Chinese dumplings, but instead they'll be filled with lamb, spiced with cumin or with pumpkin. Just turn south and you've got Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the influence there is really from the spices. They're not nearly so complex, the flavours of spices in Central Asia, but the smell of kebabs grilling with cumin and coriander on hot outdoor grills is so redolent of that area. To the west, you've got Iran, you've got Turkey, and here you've got the same flavours coming over as the Persian food, saffron, pomegranates, fresh herbs, pistachios, almonds, dried fruits. And then to the north, you've got Russia. And here, particularly as Central Asia was under Soviet rule until 1991, you've got a particularly marked influence on the cuisine. And you'll have a lot of things like dill permeating the dishes. And the flavours are such a unique fusion of flavours, because you might get, for instance, we have in the book an apricot soup. Apricots are really a key ingredient in the region and much prized. The flavours that spice it are both cumin and thyme, a very unusual mixture. Then you might get a Korean beef noodle soup. 500,000 Koreans were deported to Central Asia in World War II, so they've brought a lot of their culinary influence. But while it's essentially a Korean broth, it's also got dill and sesame in it, bringing a kind of East meets West flavour.
Is there a sort of typical dish, or am I asking for the impossible?
Well, the undisputed king of Uzbek cuisine's got to be plov. This goes by other names, a pilaf, palov, palau. But it's essentially a one-pan rice dish where rice is layered with vegetables and with meat. But it's so much more than that. It can have jeweled fruits added to it, herbs, prunes, raisins, chestnuts. It's said there are as many different kind of plovs as there are people who cook it. And when it's cooked en masse. It's cooked in these vast pans called kazans. Legend has it that Alexander the Great ordered his cooks to create a dish that could be used as a campaign meal for his soldiers. And so these vast dishes are still used today to cook for people at weddings or parties, and everyone joins together and shares this huge communal eating.
I imagine stoves collapsing under the weight.
Well, it's cooked outdoors, and these huge kazan pans, at the bottom will go meat. It's usually either lamb or beef, which is slow cooked until it's unctuous and melting at the bottom of the pan. Above this will go vegetables. Typically, in Uzbekistan, you'll have a mixture of yellow and orange carrots and onions and just a little bit of spice, cumin, paprika, a tiny bit of red pepper. And then above that comes the rice, which might be studded with whole heads of garlic or quinces, perhaps, in the autumn. And then in the heat coming from below, the steam from the meat perfumes the rice above. So that it's all scented with the flavours. And then when it's served in reverse. So you'll have the rice put at the bottom of the dish, then you'll have the vegetables and a little bit of the falling apart meat on the top.
Sounds wonderful.
And then it'll be brought to the table with wonderful herbed salads and bowls of cooling yoghurt and perhaps a scattering of quail's eggs or pomegranate seeds or depends on, you know, the chef's want.
I think a lot of people are thinking about plane tickets right now. Thank you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for having us, Lynn.
Caroline Eden and Eleanor Ford are the co-authors of Samarkand. They left us with a recipe perfect for our outdoor grilling season. Beef shashlik with tahini and pistachio sauce. Read that, kebabs. Now, you can find it at splendidtable.org. And if you want to learn more about other regional cooking from around the world, India, Thailand, Korea, Mexico, subscribe to our podcast. We've spent years talking to people who have devoted their lives to the study of a cuisine. From people like Lydia Bastianich and Mario Batali, to Mexican food authority Diana Kennedy, to David Thompson on Thailand. There's lots there. We meet up with Molly Birnbaum for a cooking tune-up of sorts. Molly is the executive editor of Cook Science from America's Test Kitchen, and she believes that good cooks are not born, they're made. And one of the keys? Understanding the science behind what we cook. And with that in mind, our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked to Molly this month about an ingredient near and dear to me, Parmigiano Reggiano.
Hey, Molly, good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
So what have you and your team been working on at America's Test Kitchen?
We have been diving into the science of Parmesan Reggiano.
So what have you discovered? New information on the goddess of cheeses?
We have discovered some new information on this goddess of cheeses, and it's actually a very simple discovery that we've made, but one that has practical applications for the home cook. So in America's Test Kitchen, we get a lot of Parmesan cheese because we are going through a ton of it all the time. We're constantly cooking in our kitchen.
And you're talking about the real Parmesan, the Parmigiano Reggiano, right, with the DOC from Italy. This is the real stuff.
Exactly. Okay. We're talking the real stuff. And in general, a wheel of Parmesan Reggiano weighs 84 pounds and can measure up to 18 inches wide and 9 inches tall. This is a huge thing. It is a very big wheel of cheese. And in the test kitchen, we purchase quarter wheels. So not a whole wheel, but still a significant amount of cheese that lasts for months in our kitchen. And what we do is we break it down so that everyone can have their own manageable pieces of this cheese. And in the process of breaking down this quarter wheel, we noticed a big difference between the cheese at the rind and the cheese at the inner part of the wheel. It almost seemed like they were two different cheeses. So we wanted to kind of get to the bottom of that. So we did blind tastings of samples of cheese taken from a bunch of different locations on a wheel of 18-month-old Parmesan Reggiano. Mainly from the outside and from the very center of the wheel. And the tasters that we asked to describe the flavor of each sample and rank them, they unanimously loved the samples from the outside of the cheese close to the rind.
Wow, that's crazy. Everyone.
Everyone. And there's a huge difference. This, the words that they used to describe it were much more nutty, much more complex, with a sharp flavor, pleasantly crumbly. The samples from the center of the wheel ranked last and were described more as clean tasting and smoother with a little bit of a plasticky texture. So those are huge differences. We wanted to know why. And what it comes down to is that when cheese ages, it undergoes a very complex process called proteolysis. And this impacts the texture and the melting qualities, basically the casein proteins, which are the most important proteins in milk and play a huge role in cheese. They kind of bind with each other, creating this very strong network. Water evaporates. It becomes a very strong kind of aged thing, and it affects the flavor pretty significantly. And in this process, which happens from the outside of the rind going in, there are little white crystals and larger round pearls that are formed through the process of proteolysis. And they're definitely not defects. You'll notice them when you eat cheese. They're kind of crunchy and super delicious. They're found in aged cheese mainly. And so we found that the crystals and the pearls were much more prolific on the outside of the cheese than the inside. And that's because of the process of aging happens from the outside in. And we wanted to find out a little bit more about what those actually were because we realized we had no idea. And in the process of researching that, we found out that the scientific community also didn't really have an idea of what those crystals and pearls were until last year. There was a paper published in Dairy Science and Technology in 2015 announcing the discovery of what these crystals actually were. And it was research conducted at the University of Vermont using an instrument called a powder X-ray diffractometer.
Wow, how exciting.
I know. I don't even know what that looks like, but it's very cool. And what they did was that they found out that the tiny white crystals in Parmesan are composed of an amino acid called tyrosine, while the small white pearls turn out to be a crystalline form of the amino acid called leucine. So that was a big discovery in the Parmesan world. They're delicious. That's what you want. You want to get a piece of Parmesan close to the rind because you want that crumbly texture, that nutty flavor, and as many of those tyrosine and leucine crystals and pearls as you possibly can.
So you're looking in the best of all possible worlds, you would be looking for a corner piece.
A corner piece is exactly what you want.
And can you tell us how we know we're buying the real Parmigiano Reggiano?
Yes, that is an important thing to know. The real Parmigiano Reggiano has a stamp on the rind so that you can see that it's actually there.
So almost always better to buy a rind piece then so you know what you're getting.
For multiple reasons, yes.
So give me an idea of a recipe you love to make with Parmesan, something for us for spring.
So something that I love to make is a Parmesan-crusted asparagus. And this is a recipe that we developed at America's Test Kitchen. And it's really interesting because it's not just Parmesan sprinkled on asparagus and roasted, which is delicious on its own as well. But for this recipe, we use ground up Parmesan, panko breadcrumbs, a little bit of butter, and then we actually whip egg whites so that the crust we're creating on these roasted asparagus spears is a little bit lighter and airier, but still with that like crispy, nutty Parmesan crust.
Sounds delicious. Do you save the rind from the Parmesan, by the way, and use it?
I always save the rind. I love to stick it in soups and stews. It gives that kind of nutty Parmesan flavor.
Yep, you don't waste any of it. It's expensive stuff.
Exactly.
It's precious stuff.
Waste nothing.
That's right. Molly, thanks. Talk to you soon.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Molly Birnbaum is executive editor of Cook Science at America's Test Kitchen, and she left us with a recipe for Parmesan-crusted asparagus, and you know where to find it. It's at splendidtable.org. Coming up, culinary historian Michael Twitty expounds on the cooking gene. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from 8 p.m. American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from 8 p.m. American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The cooking gene. That's what Southern food historian Michael Twitty calls the inseparable bonding of food and identity. He's always been fascinated by the connections between African and African-American food, but now his research goes deeper and it's more personal. He's literally traveled into his own heritage as he's crisscrossed the South. As he reported on his Cooking Gene blog, he's dug through historical records, cooked at dozens of restored plantations, built a barbecue pit and a wooden grill out of saplings, and cultivated sugarcane, rice, and cotton. His work has gotten him noticed by the TED organization, which named him one of its 2016 class of international fellows. Michael spoke about his work with our contributor, Joe Yonan. He's the food and dining editor at The Washington Post.
Michael, thank you so much for coming to talk to us today.
Thank you.
So your current focus is a project you're calling the Cooking Gene. Can you explain it to us?
The Cooking Gene is basically me exploring my family history through food from, you know, Africa to America, from slavery to freedom. And it's basically putting sort of like not so much a linear history, because that would end about Reconstruction, the stories that I'm telling. But it's also just kind of contemporary sort of like unravelings of what happens when we start to talk about race and food and ethnicity and food and how different cultures in the American South have embraced an African-influenced, the most African-influenced American food tradition, and how they relate to it in their own identity. So it's a story about family at its base level. And there are not that many American culinarians who have, you know, sort of trace their own family story, their own American journey through food. We see that in cookbooks on occasion. We see that sometimes in people referencing their grandma or something like that. But this is a little bit deeper than that. It involves DNA research. It involves genealogy. It involves just, you know, conversations between different people that I met on my journeys, but also just sort of an internal journey to kind of figure out who I am.
So tell us about a trip that resulted in something particularly surprising or meaningful to you. What happened?
So there were 3 to 4 big trips, and since then there have been little ones. When one of our excursions was to Louisiana, and, you know, that, I think it really hit me there because, you know, I was in basically a food desert. I was also in Sugarcane Alley, which is also called Cancer Alley today. I mean, this is environmental, disaster, environmental racism, plus these humongous sugarcane fields. And they're all right beside the plantations where the people you see walking around, that's where their great-grandparents and their grandparents worked, and even their parents. You know, you forget that. You forget that, you know, the millennials of today, their grandparents were in those fields of sharecroppers, mm-hmm. and that their grandparents were enslaved people. And these plantations are marketed as, you know, the monuments of the Old South. You know, they're the major drive to business to South Louisiana, the tourism. And then you go to the museum and you learn about this community. And there was one little plaque that said that the black independent farmers of Donaldsonville and businessmen decided to have like almost like a community farm where these sharecroppers who were going into debt to, you know, feed themselves and feed their families, you know, they said, well, hey, you can come here. You can get the food that you want without shame and without having to incur more debt to the plantation owners. And I just thought to myself, people are constantly hitting me up talking about how do I solve the problem of food justice? And here it is, 1912, with no Twitter, no black Twitter, no Facebook, no nothing, no Instagram, you know, no crowdfunding. And despite Jim Crow, despite segregation, despite poverty, the community banded together to, you know, meet its food needs and heal itself and be self-sufficient. And that was incredibly powerful. But it was also difficult to comprehend in the light of the fact that this community today has large swaths of food deserts. Environmentally, you know, there's chemicals being belched into the air by the second. And you're surrounded by sugar, the ultimate symbol of excess and bad health when it comes to the Atlantic world in America and slavery. It was very intense. It kind of, you know, congealed for me all the different issues that I was encountering.
Well, you seem to have been interested in these cross-cultural connections surrounding food for such a long time. You converted to Judaism when you were, I think, was it 22?
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the connections that you see between Jewish cooking and food of its various traditions and African food, African-American food, Southern food? How do those lines come together for you?
It's all about crossroads. It's all about intersections. It's all about exile and migration. You know, it's almost as if we shot every step of the way as we made our way across the world in triumph and tragedy, picking up new ingredients and new ideas. And it's interesting for me as I go about creating, you know, recipes and food ideas that blend both African and Jewish diasporas in the African-American and Jewish-American experience, how often some of the same themes come up. You know, a lot of times our traditional comfort food has now become very expensive. You know, brisket and oxtail were not the most expensive thing, you know, when they were common celebration foods, and now they are pricey, and restaurants go to great lengths to make them as fancy as you want them to be. The food has humor. The food is satirical, because it has to be. The old narrative of they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat, is equally applicable for Black and Jewish plates. And we talk about the food while we eat it incessantly, which is kind of annoying but endearing. And the most important part to me has always been that we use food as a mnemonic device. There are ancient food cultures in the world, and they don't do that. We do. Every time you sit down to the plate of kugel or the plate of chitlins, I'm just being as stereotypical as possible at the moment, you know, you're going to get a story about who it came from, why, and surrounding narratives about that food and what went into it. And that is using that food as a mnemonic device, a memory device, to sort of orient both the teller of the story and the ones who are hearing it for the first time into a bigger stream of history.
So you wrote something for the Post a while back that included the lines, "Identity cooking is when you cook what you are. That's how you can best understand me. You've got to taste my cooking. Once you taste my food, I make perfect sense." Give us an example of something that you cook that explains who you are.
Okay. So, you know, I got so tired of people going, huh? You're what? You're Black, you're gay, and you're Jewish. How is that possible? You know, how is it possible? It's America. Of course I'm possible here. If I'm not possible here, where else can I be possible? So you have to sit people down. You have to put some food in their mouth so they shut up. You have to make them chew the food, and the food has to taste good. So you have to meet all those goals, and you have to use the food to explain who you are, where you come from, and where you're going. That's a lot to ask of yourself as a cook, as a culinarian, as a food person. And it's a lot to ask of the people you're feeding in the hospitality to sort of receive all those messages. You know, I thought I was really being funny when, you know, I came up with the kosher soul roll But I really thought about it after a while and thought about this. What do black people and Jewish people in America love to eat more than anything else? Chinese food. Yes. Must be a spring roll. Two, must have pastrami in it. Three, must have collard greens in it. Four, must have a sauce that makes both people happy. And it's about negotiation. What's important? What are you going to keep? What are you going to leave behind? What are you going to compromise on? What are you going to bring together? How are you going to make it all harmonious? So that's what I mean by, you know, you understand me. Oh, you had to go through all these machinations to make this possible. Exactly. The same thing when I do, what I do when I look in the mirror. You know, I have to do a lot of work to do this. And it's not, you do it once. You do it every single day. You get better at it and it looks effortless. But it's always, it never gets any easier. It's just a process of negotiation and figuring out what ingredients will make you taste good to other people.
Michael, thank you so much for talking to us today. This is fascinating.
Well, thank you.
Michael Twitty is the author of the forthcoming book, The Cooking Gene, and the blog Afroculinaria. Joe Yonan is the author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. Check out a recipe from Chef Bryant Terry for a bit of soul food redo. Find his citrus collards with raisins at splendidtable.org.
Hello? Hey, what's going on? How come I never see you around no more? Where you been? Yeah, well, you should call me. When? Well, I get all my messages. I never got any from you.
It is time to turn to your calls. Let's connect any way we can, Facebook, Twitter, or pick up the phone and call us. 800-537-5252. Which is what Alexis has done, and Alexis is in San Antonio. Hey, Alexis, welcome. What's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I would like you to inspire me, please. I recently visited the Netherlands, and I picked up this really wonderful lavender goat cheese while I was there.
Ooh.
Yes. It's really pretty. It's blue in color. And according to the makers, they flavored it with sweet potato, apple, radishes, and cherry.
Did they miss anything? My God.
It's really great. I was very impressed. But I've never really been much of a cheese snacker. Or one that makes meals with cheese.
Right.
So I'm not really sure what to do with it besides stick it on a cracker.
Well, putting on a cracker is not a very bad idea. Now, are you tasting all those things when you taste the cheese?
No, it doesn't, you know, hit me in the face.
Yeah.
It does have a slightly sweet flavor, and you have, like, the aroma of the lavender.
Mm-hmm.
It's very nice and mild.
Then you know what might be nice to do? Okay. I love the idea of little balls of a creamy cheese in a salad.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just plop it on top, you know, as you serve the salad. But this is the time of year where you've got a lot of interesting new greens and, you know, things that are kind of tart, which with the creaminess of the goat cheese and the slight sweetness would be a nice contrast.
Mm-hmm.
You could just get one of those herb salad mixes and use that. Or you could look for things like curly endive and very young dandelion and very young arugula and things that you can't identify. For instance. Mizuni, which is fabulous. And then just a little bit of something mild, like a little romaine. And toss that with a really simple dressing. Just, you know, good vinegar, oil, and a little salt and pepper, and maybe a nice touch would be a sprinkling of nuts. And one of the things that would be great with that goat cheese and on this salad would be salted roasted pistachios.
Okay.
I love them. They're a bit of an investment, but I like to put them out with drinks and whatever. I'm really hooked on them. But anyway, then take the goat cheese and just with, you know, you can use a couple of spoons to do it, make small balls of it. And and if you can get your hands on chopped chives or chopped scallion tops, roll it in that. And you can way ahead. You can stick that in the fridge lightly covered, you know, and you can be snacking on it too. But
I love the idea of putting herbs with the cheese.
Yeah, I think it would be delicious because it's delicate and it'll set off whatever the cheese is about. But those nuts, the sweetness and that saltiness and meatiness that's almost buttery of the pistachios and then just tart greens, and you make that salad, and then
just before you, you know, you serve it, plop that goat cheese on top,
okay,
a couple of bowls. Yeah. And some good bread on the side. And that's dinner.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's one way to go. Another thing to try it with is to just spread it on something like a sliced cucumber, which is cool and really fresh and crisp. Or you could go the dessert route and you could serve it, again, little balls of it or a smear on the plate with some sweet crackers. You know, like they're these whole wheat, wholemeal crackers that are really delicious.
Yeah.
Something that has only a hint of sweetness to it. Mm-hmm. And then have fresh fruit on the plate, like strawberry.
Yeah, that all sounds really great, actually. I have salads for lunch, and I love to snack on cucumber, and why not try it with a cracker?
Yeah, and when peaches and nectarines, I don't think it'll last that long because it sounds like you like it a lot, but when peaches and nectarines start coming into season, and you're in San Antonio, maybe that happens a lot faster there than it does where I am in Minnesota.
We do have a lot of peaches down here.
You do. Okay.
Yes.
Slice up those peaches and smear them with this.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. It sounds like a fabulous cheese.
It really is. It impressed me, you know.
Great that you can get your hands on it, though, that you brought it home.
Hey. Thank you. You take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
800-537-5252. Sean's calling from St. Paul. Hey, Sean, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about streusel toppings on muffins.
Ooh. Ooh.
So my situation is that I've been a little more health conscious as of late and trying to get more carbohydrates from vegetables and from fruits. And one thing I really miss is the feeling of having that slightly crunchy streusel topping on top of a muffin. So I'm trying to figure out some kind of substitute that isn't quite as sugar and flour heavy.
And butter. Don't forget the butter. I think about that. You know, really, I really just could make chunks of streusel and skip the muffins and the cakes and the pies.
Okay. You're sending me in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I am so sorry. And by the way, if you ever had it done with good lard, it's fabulous. We won't go there. We won't go there. Okay, you know what? All right, let's think about nuts.
Okay.
Nuts with, you need a bit of fat. But that fat could be olive oil, a canola oil, and then whole grain flour mixed with white. You need a little white, but you could do a whole wheat flour. And what would be really neat, wouldn't it be cool to do something like chopped up dried fruit, peach, apricot in small pieces?
That sounds spectacular.
I think if you were to put that together, and I think a little bit of sugar is going to help this.
Gotcha.
And I'd go with brown sugar because of the moisture, and it has, I think, more of that rich caramelized flavor. And put that together and see what you get. And you could just test it out. Don't bother with the muffins. You know, crumble it up and get it into clumps and just put it on a baking sheet and bake it for a short time or the amount of time a muffin would bake at the same temperature and see what you get.
I love it. Thank you so much.
In fact, you know, that might be a great sort of thing that you would put on anything for dessert.
Yeah, or maybe on a little bit of granola, but this is a great idea, so thank you for helping me out.
Oh, Greek yogurt. Wouldn't that be great?
Absolutely.
Ooh. Okay, you're off and running.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
800-537-5252. That's one way you can get to us. The other way you can get to us is email. Go to splendidtable.org. Coming up, more of your calls. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Okay, let's get back to your calls. Pick up that phone. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. Brendan's on the line from Ames, Iowa. Brendan, what do you want to talk about today?
Well, Lynn, I want to talk about magic beans.
Do you have a beanstalk outside the door?
I do, but it doesn't produce beans like the ones that my sister-in-law brought back from Spain.
What kind of beans?
I have no idea. They were ginormous white beans, and they came in a cool bag.
Yeah.
But I don't know where to find them now.
Do they have a name?
The top of the bag says Judias de El Barco de Avila.
Okay.
A-V-I-L-A. I think that's their place of origin.
Right. Now, you haven't run into these beans specifically, but when I was in Spain, I saw quite a few beans like that. And I think these are protected by domain of origin rules, you know, their laws or regulations, where these are foods that are traditionally from this place. And now, when they're properly grown in that place, they can be labeled as such.
Sure.
And so describe what they're big and white. What's the shape? Are they sort of long or are
no,
they rounder?
They were kind of kidney bean shaped, like a big butter bean or a lima bean.
Okay.
And they're, you know, but they're about half an inch around. They were delicious. You know, when you cook them, they got that very creamy.
Yeah, I know what you have. You have one of the many forms of maybe my all-time favorite bean. In Italy, they're called Great Spanish Whites or Coronas. And I think they pop up all over the Mediterranean. I think they're the Soissons of France. And they're creamy. They don't taste, in quotes, bean-like, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They're very clean.
Oh, they're just delicious. These, okay, the way you would find them here is one of the names for them is Corona. And you can mail order them. Like, for instance, I know Chef Shop, which is based in Seattle. Chefshop.com has them. And they're not an inexpensive site, but they're a pretty dependable site in terms of, you know, the quality of what they sell.
Excellent.
And Rancho Gordo, they sell beans. I mean, they raise beans. They raise heirloom beans, and they may have them.
Rancho Gordo.
So I would check out Chef Shop. I'd check out foodsfromspain.com. I'd check out latienda.com. I'd check out Rancho Gordo, which specializes in beans. And you know, the other place I would check out is Seed Savers, because they only have seeds, but they also have heirloom beans, and they just might have them.
That will be easy.
Yeah, what's great about Seed Savers is that, you know, it's a nonprofit and it supports biodiversity. They have one of the great seed banks in the world. But any of those sources, and I agree with you, I think they're the dream bean, the magic bean.
They are. They are magical. One big pot a year would do you, but...
Yeah, but hey, it wouldn't hurt to have a pound in the, you know, hanging around, and whenever you want some, they're there.
Exactly.
Hey, thank you, Brendan. Thanks for bringing back a good memory, too.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye.
These beans are so delicious, and for summer salads... You cook them up. I cook them up with sage and garlic, and then you just let them cool, and you dress them with a little bit of olive oil, a little bit of vinegar, and then, you know, fresh herbs, and some red onion. It's a classic from Tuscany, and it's just fabulous. So, 800-537-5252. That's how you can connect with us. Well, I have to tell you, you know about farmers markets. Everybody knows about farmers markets. But the thing is, they constantly feel like you're discovering something new. Every week that you go, there's yet another thing that wasn't there the week before because the season is changing. And this is one of the things I really love. But the other things I love about farmers markets, and let me count the ways, is the money goes directly to the person growing or creating your food. So where do you go to find a farmer's market near you? Well, there is a National Farmer's Market Directory. Just check out nfmd.org. And by the way, let me tell you how I like to hit a farmer's market. Do not buy at the first stand you see something you like. You have to do a scan, and you have to taste. You know, the green beans may look great, but they may not be sweet. But at any rate, do a scan of the entire market. See what looks really prime, and then make your decisions. And of course, everybody tells us the same thing. Don't do what everyone else does, buying too much. But we're going to do it anyway. So just plan on inviting a bunch of friends over, and you can all cook together. Now, what we'd like to know is what you're picking up at your local farmer's market this summer. So share your photos with us on Instagram and Twitter and use the hashtag #SplendidMarket. And remember, you can listen to us whenever it's convenient. Just add us to your podcast queue by subscribing at iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And if you don't already, follow us on Instagram and Pinterest. Melissa's on the phone from Tampa. Melissa, hello, welcome, and what do you want to talk about?
Hi, it's so nice to talk to you.
Good to have you on.
I am doing a beer course, and I'm looking for some snacks that I can pair with the tastings.
You're running a beer course?
I'm just doing one from a book.
Oh, that's really interesting. Okay, what kind of beers are you going to be pairing up with food?
My next chapters are pale ales and IPAs.
Okay, let's see now. You're going to generally get a lot of tang from that kind of thing, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
And contrast to that, first of all, you know, the classic stuff, salty things. I mean, you could always do the popcorn route.
Where Ooh, okay.
Take garlic, thin slice it, okay? Take a bit of olive oil and just warm that in a saucepan so that the garlic gets softened. And be very careful. Don't brown the garlic. And you don't need a lot of oil. And then what you're going to do, pop the corn. And when the corn's popped, toss it with that oil and grated Parmesan cheese.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
It would be delicious, I think, with those beers. It would be a lovely contrast. Now, another kind of interesting thing to do with those beers is to contrast them with dried fruits.
Ooh, okay.
You know, I mean, it's worth a try because the intensity of a dried fruit, and I'm thinking of things that have a little bit of an acidic quality, so things like apricots, dried berries, especially things like dried raspberries, if you can find them, tart dried apples, and see what happens when you do that. You know, experiment mm-hmm. and see, what am I tasting? What's being brought out in the beer? What's being brought out in the fruit? That's another way to go. Another way to go with this is beers like that, like fat, you know, fatty things. And I'm not saying you need an excess of them, but if you were to do something like a pate, something like a liver pate, mm-hmm. or even a vegetable pate, but Ooh. Something that's really lush, and you'd only need a smear of it, you know, with the beer.
Mm-hmm.
But it would be kind of interesting because the contrast, you have a kind of aggressive yet complex beverage, and then you've got this lush, mouth-filling warmth and goodness of a pate, which definitely has generous fat in it.
Right.
Or salami.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's easy. You know, that's easy to find. Good salami, especially an Italian kind of salami. You could do a Genoa. You could do what's referred to as a hard salami or a soppressata, which is really just a salami that's been pressed. And it's delicious. So those are some thoughts for you.
Great. Thank you so much.
What a great thing. You're doing this on your own?
Yes.
Oh, and what have you learned so far? I mean, what have you tried?
I've learned so much. So far I've done the German styles, sort of like the first styles of beer. And I've learned all the differences between like lagers and ales.
Oh, this is fascinating.
Yeah, it's really fun.
You're going to be a terror in every craft beer place. Hey.
I hope so.
Thank you for a great question.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Sherman's on the phone from Harrodsburg, Kentucky. Sherman, where is Harrodsburg in Kentucky?
It's a little southwest of Lexington. It is actually the first settlement made west of the Allegheny Mountains.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Daniel Boone came here. James Harrod, after whom the town is named, established a fort here in Harrodsburg that's a great place to come and visit if you want to get to the bluegrass.
You live in one of the most beautiful states in the country, and I wish we'd heard more about it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you hear about California and you hear about all these places, but, oh, Kentucky and the food? Oh, my.
Yeah.
Okay. You probably called with something you wanted to talk about.
I did. And it's because I live in this beautiful place that's so fertile. I have this great, huge garden where I raise a lot of vegetables, but especially I raise a lot of tomatoes and hot peppers, which I turn into salsa and hot pepper relish, some of which I sell.
Oh, okay.
So all of that is great. But this year, just by chance, I got a really awesome job in California, of all places, but it's happening in August and September. So I think you can see my dilemma. That's when the tomatoes and the peppers ripen.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Is there anyone you really trust?
Well, my darling husband, who lives here with me.
Ah.
I was hopeful that you could help me figure out a way that he could harvest the fruits of my labor and maybe somehow find a way to stabilize them, keep them high enough quality that when I come home in early October, I can finish processing.
So you're talking about essentially keeping them for a month.
2 months.
Month
to 2 months.
Hmm.
Now, both of the things that I'm going to be making with these vegetables have to be cooked down for 45 minutes or so.
Oh.
What about freezing?
That's going to change the texture, but if you're going to cook it down anyway...
That's what I was...
Yeah, I think that's not a bad idea.
Now,
I freeze my tomatoes all the time.
How do you freeze your tomatoes?
What I do is... Now, this is if they're paste tomatoes, you know, very dense.
Mm-hmm.
They work a bit better. The regular tomato, which I still freeze like crazy, sometimes throws off a lot of liquid.
Right.
And what I might do is let them defrost, put them in a strainer, let them just sit there. All that liquid will get boiled down, but it will not get boiled down with the tomatoes if I want a fresh taste from the tomatoes.
Okay.
It all depends what I'm doing. But with my tomatoes, if they're large, I'll slice them in half. I do skin, seeds, and all. And you know how all these recipes say peel and seed your tomatoes?
Always.
Right. Guess where the majority of the taste than any other part of the tomato exists? It's in the seeds and in that gel around the seeds.
No kidding.
Absolutely.
I should save them.
Yes, exactly. I did a test at one point. I had two identical tomato sauce recipes, two identical pots, and I had a stove with two identical burners. We did one test with just taking the tomatoes and squishing them, peel seeds and all, and we did another test where we peeled and seeded. And we cooked the sauce exactly the same way. And then we did a blind tasting with a bunch of friends. And every one of them preferred the sauce that had the seeds and the peel. Now, I mean, if you want to lift the peel out or whatever, you can. But if you're going to cook it down, give it everything. So cut them up if you have to. If they're small, you don't have to. Put them in a heavy-duty plastic bag. Press out all the air. Lay them flat. You know, I usually do.
I have a vacuum sealer. Would that work?
Oh, that would be even better.
Great.
Now, with the peppers and that kind of thing, I double-check canning and freezing instructions just to be sure they don't need to be blanched. They may need to be dropped in water, boiling water for a few moments.
Okay.
And then pulled.
Now, I typically grind them up with onions and soak them in salt for 3 to 4 hours. What if I ask my husband to grind them fresh with onions, soak them in salt, and then freeze?
No, and I would do that after you freeze. You'll have some excess liquid, which you can drain and boil down because that's all flavor. But I wouldn't do that far in advance
because
I don't know what's going to happen to them when you freeze.
Great.
You follow me? But that would probably be your best bet.
Oh, thank you. I'm really looking forward to going to California, but I sure hate missing August and September.
I think you've got a great survival plan here, and it sounds like your husband's a gem.
He is. Thank you so much, Lynn.
You are welcome, Sherman. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Frances Lam is going to be in the host seat next week. You have a great week. And before I go, let me leave you with this thought from PJ O'Rourke, who said, "A fruit is a vegetable with looks and money. Plus, if you let fruit rot, it turns into wine. Something Brussels sprouts never do." SplendidTable.org has everything you will ever need. And if you like what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We have quite an archive of conversations with the people who shape America's food scene. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.